by a computer. We have computers here. One you see in my office. You have no idea who could have sent it. Father Sebastian had hardly glanced at it before handing it back with a gesture of contemptuous dismissal. None. We have our enemies. Perhaps that's too strong a word. It would be more accurate to say that we have people who would prefer this college not to exist, but their opposition to us is ideological, theological, or financial, a question of church resources. I can't believe that any would sink to this crude calumny. I'm surprised Sir Alred took it seriously. As a man of power, he can't be unused to anonymous communications. We shall, of course, give you any help we can. No doubt you will want first to visit the place where Ronald died. Please forgive me if I leave Father Martin to accompany you. I have a visitor this afternoon and other rather urgent matters awaiting attention. Evensong is at 5 o'clock, if you wish to join us. Afterwards, I have drinks here before dinner. We don't serve wine at meals on Fridays, as I expect you remember. But when we have guests, it seems reasonable to offer them sherry before the meal. We have 4 other visitors this weekend. Archdeacon Crampton, a trustee of the college. Dr. Emma Lavenham, who comes once a term from Cambridge to introduce the students to the literary heritage of Anglicanism. Dr. Clive Stannard, who is using our library for research. And another police officer, Inspector Roger Yarwood of the local force, who is at present on sick leave. None of them was present at the time of Ronald's death. If you are interested in knowing who was in residence at the time, Father Martin will be able to supply a list. Are we to expect you for dinner? Not tonight, Father, if you'll excuse me. I hope to be back for Compline. Then I shall see you in church. I hope you find your rooms comfortable. Father Sebastian got to his feet. Obviously, the interview was over. 9. Father Martin said, I expect you'd like to visit the church on the way to your rooms. It was obvious that he took Dalgleish's agreement, even enthusiasm, for granted. And indeed, Dalgleish wasn't unwilling. There were things in the little church that he had looked forward to seeing again. He said, The Van der Weyden Madonna is still above the altar? Yes, indeed. That and the doom are our 2 main attractions. But perhaps the word attractions isn't quite appropriate. I don't mean that we encourage visitors. We don't get many, and they always come by appointment. We don't advertise our riches. Is the Van der Weyden insured, Father? No, it never has been. We can't afford the premium, and as Father Sebastian has said, the picture is irreplaceable. Money doesn't buy another. But we do take care. Of course, being so isolated helps, and we now have a modern alarm system operating. The panel is inside the door leading from the northern cloister to the sanctuary, and the alarm also covers the main south door. I think the system was installed well after your visit here. The bishop insisted that we take advice on security if the painting is to remain in the church, and, of course, he was right. Dalgleish said, I seem to remember that the church was open all day when I was here as a boy. Yes, indeed, but that was before the experts decided that the painting was genuine. It distresses me that the church has to be kept locked, particularly in a theological college. That's why, when I was warden, I installed the small oratory. I expect you saw it to the left of the door when you came in. The oratory itself can't be consecrated because it's part of another building, but the altar is, and it does provide a place for the students to go for private prayer or for meditation when the church is locked after services. They passed through the cloakroom at the rear of the house, which gave access to the door to the north cloister. Here the room was bisected by a row of coat hooks above a long bench, each hook with a receptacle underneath for outdoor shoes and boots. Most of the hooks were empty, but about 6 held brown hooded cloaks. No doubt the cloaks, like the black cassocks the students wore indoors, had been prescribed by the formidable founder, Agnes Arbuthnot. If so, she had probably remembered the force and bitterness of the east winds on this unprotected coast. To the right of the cloakroom, the half-open door to the utility room gave sight of four large washing machines and a dryer. Dalgleish and Father Martin passed from the dimness of the house into the cloister, and the faint but pervasive smell of high Anglican academe gave way to fresh air and the sunlit, silent courtyard. Dalgleish experienced, as he had as a boy, the sense of moving back in time. Here, red-brick, embellished Victoriana was replaced by stone simplicity. The cloisters, with their narrow and slender pillars, ran round the three sides of the cobbled courtyard. They were paved with York stone, behind which a row of identical oak doors led to the two-story student accommodation. The four apartments for visitors faced the west front of the main building, and were separated from the church wall by a wrought-iron gate behind which could be glimpsed the empty acres of pale scrubland and the richer green of the far fields of sugar beet. In the middle of the courtyard, a mature horse chestnut was already showing its autumnal decrepitude. From the foot of the gnarled trunk, from which sections of bark were breaking away like scabs, small branches had sprouted, the young leaves as green and tender as the first shoots of spring. Above them the huge boughs were hung with yellow and brown, and the dead leaves lay curled on the cobbles, as dried and brittle as mummified fingers among the polished mahogany of the fallen chestnuts. Some things, thought Dalgleish, were new to him in this long-remembered scene. Among them surely the rows of unadorned but elegantly shaped terracotta pots at the foot of the pillars. They must have made a brave show in summer, but now the distorted stems of the geraniums were woody and the few remaining flowers only a puny reminder of past glories. And surely the fuchsia, climbing so vigorously over the west-facing wall of the house, had been planted since his time. It was still heavy with flowers, but the leaves were already fading, and the fallen petals lay in drifts, like spilt blood. Father Martin said, "We'll go in through the sacristy door." He drew out a large keyring from the pocket of his cassock. "I'm afraid it takes me a little time to find the right keys. I know I ought to know them by now, but there are so many of them, and I'm afraid I shall never get used to the security system. It's set to give us a whole minute before we have to punch in the four digits, but the bleep is so low that now I can hardly hear it. Father Sebastian dislikes loud noise, particularly in the church. If the alarm is set off, it makes a terrifying jangle in the main building." "Shall I do it for you, Father?" "Oh, no, thank you, Adam. No, I'll manage. I never have difficulty in remembering the number, because it's the year Miss Arbuthnot founded the college, 1861. And that, thought Dalgleish, was a number that might easily occur to the mind of a prospective intruder. The sacristy was larger than Dalgleish remembered, and obviously served as vestry, cloakroom, and office. To the left of the door leading into the church was a row of coat hooks. Another wall was occupied with ceiling-high-fitted cupboards for vestments. There were two upright wooden chairs and a small sink with a draining board beside a cupboard whose formica top held an electric kettle and a cafetiere. Two large tins of white paint and a small one of black, with brushes in a jam jar at their side, were neatly stacked against the wall. To the left of the door and under one of the two windows was a large desk fitted with drawers and holding a silver cross. Above it was a wall-mounted safe. Seeing Dalgleish's eyes on it, Father Martin said, "Father Sebastian had the safe installed to hold our 17th-century silver chalices and pattern. They were bequeathed to the college by Miss Arbuthnot and are very fine. Previously, because of their value, they were kept in the bank. But Father Sebastian felt that they should be used, and I think he was right." Beside the desk was a row of framed sepia photographs, nearly all of them old, some obviously dating back to the early days of the college. Dalgleish, interested in old photographs, moved over to look at them. One, he thought, must be of Miss Arbuthnot. She was flanked by two priests, each in cassock and beretta, both taller than herself. To Dalgleish's fleeting but intense scrutiny, there was no doubt which was the dominant personality. So far from seeming diminished by the black, clerical austerity of her custodians, Miss Arbuthnot stood perfectly at ease, fingers loosely clasped over the folds of her skirt. Her clothes were simple but expensive. Even in a photograph it was possible to see the sheen of the high-buttoned silk blouse with its leg of mutton sleeves and the richness of the skirt. She wore no jewellery except for a cameo brooch at her neck and a single pendant cross. Beneath the strong upward sweep of hair, which looked very fair, the face was heart-shaped, the eyes with their steady gaze wide-spaced under straight and darker brows. Dalgleish wondered what she would have looked like if ever this slightly intimidating seriousness had broken into laughter. It was, he thought, the photograph of a beautiful woman who took no joy in her beauty and who had looked elsewhere for the gratifications of power. Memory of the church came back to him with the smell of incense and candle smoke. They moved down the northern aisle, and Father Martin said, "You'd like, of course, to see the doom again?" The doom could be illumined by a light fixed to a nearby pillar. Father Martin lifted his arm, and the tenebrous, indecipherable scene sprang into life. They were facing a vivid depiction of the Last Judgment, painted on wood, the whole shaped in a half-moon with a diameter of about 12 feet. At the head was the seated figure of Christ in glory, holding out his wounded hands over the drama below. The central figure was obviously St. Michael. He was holding a heavy sword in his right hand, and in his left, dangling scales in which he was weighing the souls of the righteous and the unrighteous. To his left, the devil, with scaly tail and grinning lascivious jaws, the personification of horror, prepared to claim his prize. The virtuous lifted pale hands in prayer. The damned were a squirming mass of black, pot-bellied, open-mouthed hermaphrodites. Beside them, a group of lesser devils, with pitchforks and chains, were busily shoving their victims into the jaws of an immense fish with teeth like a row of swords. To the left, heaven was depicted as a castellated hotel, with an angel as doorkeeper welcoming in the naked souls. St. Peter, in cope and triple tiara, was receiving the more important of the blessed. All were naked, but still wearing the accoutrement of rank. A cardinal in his scarlet hat, a bishop in his mitre, a king and queen both crowned. There was, thought Dalgleish, little democracy about this medieval vision of heaven. All the blessed, to his eyes, wore expressions of pious boredom. The damned were considerably more lively, more defiant than regretful, as they plunged feet first down the fish's throat. One, indeed, larger than the rest, was resisting his fate and making what looked like a finger-to-nose gesture in contempt towards the figure of St. Michael. The doom, originally more prominently displayed, was designed to terrify medieval congregations into virtue and social conformity, literally through the fear of hell. Now it was viewed by interested academics or by modern visitors for whom the fear of hell no longer had power, and who sought heaven in this world, not in the next. As they stood regarding it together, Father Martin said, "Of course, it's a remarkable doom. Probably one of the best in the country, but I can't help wishing we could put it somewhere else. It probably dates from about 1480. I don't know whether you've seen the Winhaston doom. This is so like it that it must have been painted by the same monk from Blythburgh. While theirs was left outside for some years and has been restored, ours is far more in its original condition. We were lucky. It was discovered in the 1930s in a two-storied barn near Wissett, where it was used to partition a room. So it's been in the dry probably since the 1800s. Father Martin switched off the light and prattled on happily. "We had a very early circular tower, standing by itself. You may know the one at Bramfield, but that has long since gone. This was a seven-sacrament font, but as you can see, little of the carving remains. Legend has it that the font was dredged up from the sea in a great storm in the late 1700s. We don't know, of course, whether it was originally here or belongs to one of the drowned churches. Many centuries are represented here. As you see, we still have 4 17th-century box pews. Despite their age, it was the Victorians who came to mind when Dalgleish saw box pews. Here the squire and his family could sit in wood-enclosed privacy, unseen by the rest of the congregation and hardly viewed from the pulpit. He pictured them closeted together and wondered whether they took with them cushions and rugs, or provided themselves with sandwiches, drinks, and perhaps even a discreetly covered book to alleviate the hours of abstinence and the tedium of the sermon. As a boy, his mind had been much exercised with wondering what the squire would do if he suffered from a weak bladder. How could he, or indeed the rest of the congregation, sit through the 2 services on Sacrament Sunday, through long sermons, or when the litany was said or sung? Was it perhaps usual to have a chamber pot tucked away under the wooden seat? And now they were walking up the aisle towards the altar. Father Martin moved to a pillar behind the pulpit and put up his hand to a switch. Immediately the gloom of the church seemed to deepen into a darkness as, with dramatic suddenness, the painting glowed into life and colour. The figures of the Virgin and St. Joseph, fixed in their silent adoration for over 500 years, seemed for a moment to float away from the wood on which they were painted, to hang like a trembling vision on the still air. The Virgin had been painted against a background of intricate brocade in gold and brown, which in its richness emphasized her simplicity and vulnerability. She was seated on a low stool with the naked Christ child resting on a white cloth on her lap. Her face was a pale and perfect oval, the mouth tender under a narrow nose, the heavily lidded eyes under thinly arched brows fixed on the child with an expression of resigned wonder. From a high, smooth forehead, the strands of crimped auburn hair fell over her blue mantle to the delicate hands and fingers barely touching in prayer. The child gazed up at her with both arms raised, as if foreshadowing the crucifixion. St. Joseph, red-coated, was seated to the right in the painting, a prematurely aged, half-sleeping custodian, heavily leaning on a stick. For a moment, Dalgleish and Father Martin stood in silence. Father Martin didn't speak until he had turned off the light. Dalgleish wondered whether he had been inhibited from mundane conversation while the painting was working its magic. Now, he said, "The experts seem to agree that it's a genuine Roger van der Weyden, probably painted between 1440 and 1445. The other 2 panels probably showed saints with portraits of the donor and his family." Dalgleish asked, "What is its provenance?" "Miss Arbuthnot gave it to the college the year after we were founded. She intended it as an altarpiece, and we've never considered having it anywhere else. It was my predecessor, Father Nicholas Warburg, who called in the experts. He was very interested in paintings, particularly Netherlands Renaissance, and had a natural curiosity to know whether it was genuine. In the document which accompanied the gift, Miss Arbuthnot merely described it as part of an altar triptych, showing St. Mary and St. Joseph, possibly attributable to Roger van der Weyden. I can't help feeling that it would be better if we'd left it like that. We could just enjoy the painting without being obsessed with its safety." "How did Miss Arbuthnot acquire it?"
"Oh, by purchase. A landed family was disposing of some of its art treasures to help keep the estate going, that kind of thing. I don't think Miss Arbuthnot paid very highly for it. There was the doubt about the attribution, and even if genuine, this particular painter wasn't as well known or as highly regarded in the 1860s as he is today. It's a responsibility, of course. I know that the Archdeacon feels very strongly that it ought to be moved."
"Moved where?"
"To a cathedral, perhaps, where greater security would be possible. Perhaps even to a gallery or a museum. I believe he has even suggested to Father Sebastian that it should be sold."
Dalgleish said, "And the money given to the poor?"
Well, to the church. His other argument is that more people should have a chance to enjoy it. Why should a small, remote theological college add this to our other privileges? There was a note of bitterness in Father Martin's voice. Dalgliesh didn't speak, and after a pause his companion, as if feeling that he may have gone too far, went on. These are valid arguments. Perhaps we ought to take account of them, but it's difficult to visualize the church without the altarpiece. It was given by Miss Arbuthnot to be placed above the altar in this church, and I think we should strongly resist any suggestion that it should be moved. I could willingly part with the doom, but not with this. But as they turned away, Dalgliesh's mind was busy with more secular considerations. It hadn't taken Sir Alred's words about the vulnerability of the college to remind him how uncertain its future must be. What long-term future was there for the college, its ethos out of sympathy with the prevailing views of the church, educating only 20 students, occupying this remote and inaccessible site? If its future was now in balance, the mysterious death of Ronald Treves might be the one factor that tipped the scales. And if the college closed, what happened to the Van der Weyden, to the other expensive objects bequeathed to it by Miss Arbuthnot, to the building itself? Remembering that photograph, it was difficult to believe that she hadn't, however reluctantly, envisaged this possibility and made provision for it. One returned, as always, to the central question. Who benefits? He would like to have asked Father Martin, but decided it would be both tactless and, in this place, inappropriate. But the question would have to be asked. 10. The four sets of accommodation for guests had been named by Miss Arbuthnot after the four doctors of the Western Church: Gregory, Augustine, Jerome, and Ambrose. After this theological conceit, and the decision that the four cottages for staff should be called Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, inspiration had apparently faltered, and the sets for the students were less imaginatively, but more conveniently identified by numbers in the north and south cloisters. Father Martin said, "You used to be in Jerome when you were here as a boy. Perhaps you remember. It's our one double now, so the bed should be comfortable. It's the second along from the church. I've no key for you, I'm afraid. We never have had keys to the guest rooms. Everything is safe here. If you do have any papers you feel should be locked away, Miss Ramsay will look after them. She will be here at 9 o'clock on Monday. I hope you'll be comfortable, Adam. As you see, the sets have been refurbished since your last visit." They had indeed. Where before the sitting room had been a cozy, overcrowded repository for odd items of furniture which looked as if they were the rejects of the parish jumble sale, it was now as starkly functional as a student's study. Nothing here was superfluous. Unfussy and conventional modernity had replaced individuality. There was a table with drawers, which could also serve as a desk, set before the window, which gave a view westward over the scrubland. Two easy chairs, one on each side of the gas fire, a low table, and a bookcase. To the right of the fireplace was a cupboard with a formica top holding a tray with an electric kettle, a teapot, and two cups and saucers. Father Martin said, "There's a small refrigerator in that cupboard, and Mrs. Pilbeam will put in a pint of milk each day. As you will see when you go upstairs, we've installed a shower in what was part of the bedroom. You'll remember that when you were here last, you had to walk along the cloisters and use one of the bathrooms in the main house." Dalgliesh did remember. It had been one of the pleasures of his stay to walk out in his dressing gown into the morning air, a towel round his shoulders, either to the bathroom or to walk the half mile to the bathing hut for a pre-breakfast swim. The small modern shower was a poor substitute. Father Martin said, "I'll wait for you here while you unpack, if I may. There are two things I want to show you." The bedroom was as simply furnished as the room beneath. There was a double wooden bed with a bedside table and reading lamp, a fitted cupboard, another bookcase, and an easy chair. Dalgliesh unzipped his travelling bag and hung up the one suit he had thought it necessary to bring.
After a brief wash, he rejoined Father Martin, who was standing at the window looking out over the headland. As Dalgliesh entered, Father Martin took a folded sheet of paper from the pocket of his cloak. He said, "I have something you left here when you were 14. I didn't send it on because I wasn't sure whether you'd be happy to know that I'd seen it, but I've kept it, and perhaps you'd now like it back. It's 4 lines of verse. I suppose you could call it a poem." And that, thought Dalgliesh, was an unlikely supposition. He suppressed a groan and took the paper held out to him. What youthful indiscretion, embarrassment, or pretension was now to be resurrected from the past to his discomfort? The sight of the handwriting, familiar and yet strange, and to his eyes, despite the careful calligraphy, a little tentative and unformed, jolted him back over the years more strongly than an old photograph, because it was more personal. It was difficult to believe that the boyish hand which had moved over this quarter sheet of paper was the same as the hand that now held it. He read the line silently. "The bereaved. Another lovely day," you said in passing, dull-voiced, and moved, unseeing, down the street. You didn't say, "Please wrap your jacket round me. Outside the sun, inside the killing sleet." It brought back another memory, one which was common in his childhood. His father taking a burial service, the richness of the clods of earth heaped beside the bright green of artificial grass, a few wreaths, the wind billowing his father's surplice, the smell of flowers. Those lines, he remembered, had been written after the burial of an only child. He remembered, too, that he had worried over the adjective in its last line, thinking the two vowel sounds were too similar, yet unable to find a suitable substitute. Father Martin said, "I thought they were remarkable lines for a 14-year-old. Unless you want them back, I should like to keep them." Dalgliesh nodded and handed over the paper silently. Father Martin folded it back in his pocket with something of the satisfaction of a child. Dalgliesh said, "There was something else you wanted to show me." "Yes, indeed. Perhaps we could sit down." Again, Father Martin slipped a hand into his deep cloak pocket. He brought out what looked like a child's exercise book rolled up and bound with a rubber band. Smoothing it out on his lap and folding his hands over it, as if he were protecting it, he said, "Before we go to the beach, I'd like you to read this. It's self-explanatory. The woman who wrote it died of a heart attack on the evening of the final entry. It may have no significance whatsoever for Ronald's death. I've shown it to Father Sebastian, and that's his view. He thinks it can safely be ignored. It could mean nothing, but it worries me. I thought it would be a good idea to show it to you here, where we have no chance of being interrupted. The two entries I'd like you to read are the first and the last." He handed over the book and sat in silence until Dalgliesh had read it. Dalgliesh asked, "How did you come by it, Father?" "I looked for it and found it. Margaret Munro was found dead in her cottage by Mrs. Pilbeam at 6:15 on Friday, 13 October. She was on her way to the college and was surprised to see a light on so early in St. Matthew's cottage. After Dr. Metcalf, he's the general practitioner who looks after us at St. Anselm's, had seen the body and it had been removed, I thought about my suggestion that Margaret should write an account of finding Ronald and wondered whether in fact she had done so. I found this under her stack of writing paper in the drawer of a small wooden desk she had in her cottage. There had been no serious attempt to conceal it." "And as far as you can tell, no one else knows of this diary's existence?" "No one, except Father Sebastian. I'm sure Margaret wouldn't have confided even in Mrs. Pilbeam, who was the member of staff closest to her, and there was no sign that a search had been made of the cottage. The body looked perfectly peaceful when I was called. She was just sitting in her chair with her knitting in her lap."
"And you have no idea what she's referring to?"
"None. It must have been something she saw or heard on the day of Ronald's death which sparked off memory. That and Eric Surtees' gift of leeks. He's a handyman here, helping Reg Pilbeam. But of course you know that from the diary. I can't think what it could have been."
"Was her death unexpected?" Not really. She'd had a serious heart condition for some years. Dr. Metcalf and the consultant she saw in Ipswich both discussed with her the possibility of a heart transplant. But she was adamant that she didn't want an operation of any kind. She said that scarce resources should be used on the young and on parents bringing up children. I don't think Margaret cared very much whether she lived or died after her son was killed. She wasn't morbid about it. It was just that she wasn't enough attached to life to fight for it. Dalgleish said, I'd like to keep this diary, if I may. Father Sebastian may be right. It could be totally without significance. But it's an interesting document if one is considering the circumstances of Ronald Treves' death. He put the exercise book away in his briefcase, shut it, and set the combination lock. They sat for another half minute in silence. It seemed to Dalgleish that the air between them was heavy with unspoken fears, half-formed suspicions, a general sense of unease. Ronald Treves had died mysteriously, and a week later the woman who had found his body, and who had subsequently discovered a secret which she felt was important, was herself dead. It could be no more than a coincidence. There was so far no evidence of foul play, and he shared what he guessed was Father Martin's reluctance to hear those words spoken aloud. Dalgleish said, Did you find the verdict of the inquest surprising? A little surprising. I would have expected an open verdict, but the thought that Ronald could have killed himself, and by an act so appalling, is one we here can hardly bear to let into our minds. What sort of a boy was he? Was he happy here? I'm not sure that he was, although I don't think any other theological college would have suited him better. He was intelligent and hard-working, but singularly lacking in charm, poor boy. He was curiously judgmental for someone young. I would have said he combined a certain insecurity with considerable self-satisfaction. He had no particular friends. Not that particular friendships are encouraged, and I think he may have been lonely. But there was nothing in his work or his life here to suggest despair, or that he was tempted to the grievous sin of self-destruction. Of course, if he did kill himself, then we must be in some way to blame. We should have seen that he was suffering. But then he gave no indication. And you were happy about his vocation? Father Martin took his time before replying. Father Sebastian was, but I wonder whether he may not have been influenced by Ronald's academic record. He wasn't as clever as he thought he was, but he was clever. I had my doubts. It seemed to me that Ronald was desperate to impress his father. Obviously, he couldn't measure up in his father's world, but he could choose a career which would offer no possible comparison. And with the priesthood, particularly the Catholic priesthood, there's always the temptation of power. Once ordained, he would be able to pronounce absolution. That, at least, is something his father couldn't do. I have not said this to anyone else, and I could be wrong. When his application was considered, I felt I was in some difficulty. It is never easy for a warden to have his predecessor still in college. This was a matter on which I didn't feel it right to oppose Father Sebastian. But it was with a sense of deepening, if illogical, unease that Dalgleish heard Father Martin say, And now I expect you would like to see where he died. 11. Eric Surtees left St. John's Cottage by the back door and walked between his neat rows of autumn vegetables to commune with his pigs. Lily, Marigold, Daisy and Myrtle came galumphing across to him in a squealing mass and raised their pink snouts to sniff his coming. Whatever his mood, a visit to his self-built piggery and its railed enclosure could meet his need. But today, as he leaned over and scratched Myrtle's back, nothing could lift the weight of anxiety that lay like a physical load on his shoulders. His half-sister, Karen, was due to arrive in time for tea. Usually she drove from London every third weekend, and whatever the weather, those 2 days always remained sunlit in his memory, and warmed and lightened the weeks between. In the last 4 years she had changed his life. He couldn't now imagine his life without her. Normally, her coming this weekend would be a bonus. She had been with him only the Sunday before, but he knew that she was coming because she had something to ask of him. A request to make which he had refused the previous week, and knew that he must somehow find the strength to refuse again. Leaning over the fence of the pigsty, he thought back over the last 4 years, about himself and Karen. The relationship hadn't at first been propitious. He had been 26 when they met. She was 3 years younger, and for the first 10 years of her life her existence had been unknown to him and his mother. His father, a traveling representative for a large publishing conglomerate, had successfully run 2 establishments until, after 10 years, the financial and physical strain and the complications of the balancing act had become too much for him, and he had thrown in his lot with his mistress and departed. Neither Eric nor his mother had been particularly sorry to see him go. There was nothing she enjoyed more than a grievance, and her husband had now handed her one which kept her in a state of happy indignation and fierce battling for the final 10 years of her life. She fought, but unsuccessfully, to own the London house, insisted on having custody of the only child. There was no battle there, and conducted a long and acrimonious dispute about the allocation of income. Eric had never seen his father again. The 4-story house was part of a Victorian terrace near the Oval Underground Station. After his mother's protracted death from Alzheimer's disease, he stayed on alone, having been informed by his father's solicitor that he could continue to do so rent-free until his father died. 4 years ago, a massive heart attack killed him instantly while on the road, and Eric discovered that the house had been left jointly to him and his half-sister. He had seen her for the first time at his father's funeral. The event, it could hardly be dignified by a more ceremonial name, had taken place at a North London crematorium without benefit of clergy, indeed without benefit of mourners except for himself and Karen, and 2 representatives of the firm. The disposal had taken only minutes. Coming out of the crematorium, his half-sister had said without preamble, "That's how Dad wanted it. He never went in for religion. He didn't want any flowers and he didn't want any mourners. We'll have to talk about the house, but not now. I have an urgent appointment at the office. It hasn't been easy to get off." She hadn't invited him to drive back with her, and he went home alone to the empty house. But next day she had called. He vividly remembered opening the door. She was wearing, as she had at the funeral, tight black leather trousers, a baggy red sweater and high-heeled boots. Her hair looked spiky, as if it had been brilliantined, and there was a glittering stud in the left of her nose. Her appearance was conventionally outré, but he found to his surprise that he rather liked the way she looked. They moved into the rarely used front room without speaking, and she looked round with an appraising, then dismissive glance at the leavings of his mother's life, the cumbersome furniture which he had never bothered to replace, the dusty curtains hung with the pattern towards the street, the mantel shelf crowded with gaudy ornaments brought back from his mother's holidays in Spain. She said, "We've got to make a decision about the house. We can sell now and each take half the profit, or we can let. Or, I suppose, we could spend a bit of capital on doing some adaptations and convert it into 3 studio flats. This won't be cheap, but Dad left an insurance policy, and I don't mind spending it as long as I get a higher proportion of the rents. What do you think of doing, by the way? I mean, did you expect to stay here?" He said, "I don't really want to stay in London. I was thinking, if we sell the house, I'd have enough money to buy a small cottage somewhere. I might try market gardening, something like that." "Then you'd be a fool. It'd need more capital than you're likely to get, and there's no money in it anyway, not on the kind of scale you're thinking of. Still, if you want to get out, I suppose you're keen on selling." He thought, "She knows what she wants to do, and it will happen in the end, no matter what I say." But he didn't really greatly care. He followed her from room to room in a kind of wonder. He said, "I don't mind keeping it on, if that's what you want." "Well, it's not what I want. It's what's the most sensible thing for us both. The housing market's good at present and likely to get better. Of course, if we do convert, it will lessen its value as a family residence. On the other hand, it would bring us in a regular income. And that, inevitably, was what had happened. She had, he knew, begun by despising him, but as they worked together, her attitude perceptibly changed. She was surprised and gratified to discover how good he was with his hands, how much money was saved because he could paint and paper walls, put up shelves, install cupboards. He had never bothered to improve the house, which had been his home only in name. Now he discovered unexpected and satisfying skills. They employed a professional plumber, an electrician, and a builder for the major work, but much of it was done by Eric. They became involuntary partners. On Saturdays they would shop for second-hand furniture, for bargains in bed linen and cutlery, showing each other their trophies with the happy triumph of children. He showed her how to use a blowtorch safely, insisted on the proper preparation of the woodwork before painting despite her protests that it wasn't necessary, amazed her by the careful dedication with which he measured up and fitted the kitchen units. As they worked, she gossiped about her own life, the freelance journalism in which she was beginning to make a name, her pleasure in achieving a byline, the bitchiness and gossip and small scandals of the literary world on the fringe of which she worked. It was a world which he found terrifyingly alien. He was glad he was not required to enter it. He dreamed of a cottage, a kitchen garden, and perhaps his secret passion of keeping pigs. And he could remember, of course he could, the day when they became lovers. He had fixed slatted wooden blinds to one of the south-facing windows, and they were emulsion painting the walls together. She was a messy worker, and halfway through announced that she was hot, sticky, splattered with paint, and would take a shower. It would be a chance to test the efficiency of the newly installed bathroom. So he, too, had stopped painting, and had sat cross-legged, resting against the one unpainted wall, watching the light slant in through the half-open blinds, to lattice the paint-splattered floor, and letting happy contentment bubble up like a spring. And then she had come in. She had a twisted towel round her waist, but was otherwise naked, and she was carrying a large bath mat over her arm. Laying it down, she had squatted there and, laughing at him, had held out her arms. In a kind of trance, he had knelt in front of her and whispered, "But we can't. We can't. We're brother and sister." "Only half-brother, half-sister. All to the good. Keep it in the family," he had muttered. "The blind. It's too light." She had sprung up and pulled the blind shut. The room was almost dark. She came back to him and held his head against her breasts. It had been for him the first time, and it changed his life. He knew that she didn't love him, and he didn't yet love her. During that and subsequent astonishing lovemaking, he had shut his eyes and indulged all his private fantasies, romantic, tender, violent, shameful. The imaginings tumbled into his brain and were made flesh. And then, one day, for the first time, when they were making love more comfortably on the bed, he had opened his eyes and looked into hers and had known that this was love. It was Karen who had found for him the job at St. Anselm's. She had had an assignment in Ipswich and had picked up a copy of the East Anglian Daily News. Returning that night, she had come to the house in which he was now picnicking in the basement while the work continued, and had brought the paper with her. "This might suit you. It's a handyman's job at a theological college just south of Lowestoft. That should be lonely enough for you. They're offering a cottage, and apparently there's a garden, and I dare say you could persuade them to let you keep hens if you wanted." "I don't want hens. I'd rather have pigs." "Well, pigs, then, if they're not too smelly. Now, they're not paying much, but you should get £250 a week from the rents here. You could probably save some of that. What do you think?" He had thought it almost too good to be true. She said, "Of course, they might want a married couple, but it doesn't say so. But we'd better get moving on it. I'll drive you down tomorrow morning, if you like. Phone up now and ask for an appointment. They give a number." Next day she had driven him to Suffolk, leaving him at the gate of the college, saying she would return and wait for him in an hour. He had been interviewed by Father Sebastian Morel and Father Martin Petri. He had worried in case they had wanted a clerical reference or asked him if he were a regular churchgoer, but religion hadn't been mentioned. Karen had said, "You'll be able to get a reference from the town hall, of course, but you'd better prove that you're a good handyman. It's not an office drudge they're looking for. I've brought a camera along. I'll take photographs of those cupboards, shelves, and fitments you've put up, and you can show them the Polaroids. You've got to sell yourself, remember?" But he didn't need to sell himself. He had answered their questions simply and had taken out his Polaroids with a rather touching eagerness which had shown them how much he wanted the job. They had taken him to view the cottage. It was larger than he had expected or wanted, but it lay some 80 yards from the back of the college, with an unobstructed view across the scrubland and with a small, untended garden. He hadn't mentioned the pigs until he had worked there for over a month, but when he did, no one had raised any objection. Father Martin had said a little nervously, "They won't get out, will they, Eric?" as if he had been proposing to cage Alsatians. "No, Father. I thought I could build a sty and enclosure for them. I'll show you the drawings, of course, before I buy the wood." "What about the smell?" Father Sebastian inquired. "I'm told pigs don't smell, but I can usually smell them. Of course, I may have a more sensitive nose than most people." "No, they won't smell, Father. Pigs are very clean creatures." So he had his cottage, his garden, his pigs, and once every 3 weeks he had Karen. He couldn't think of a life more satisfactory. At St. Anselm's, he had found the peace that all his life he had been looking for. He couldn't understand why it was so necessary to him, this absence of noise, of controversy, of the pressures of discordant personalities. It wasn't as if his father had ever been violent towards him, for most of the time he hadn't even been present, and when he was present, his parents' discordant marriage had been more a matter of grumbling and muttered grievances than of raised voices or open anger. What he saw as his timidity seemed to have been part of his personality since childhood. Even when working in the town hall, hardly the most provocative or exhilarating of jobs, he had held apart from the occasional spats of ill-feeling, the minor feuds which some workers seemed to find necessary, indeed to provoke. Until he knew and loved Karen, no company in the world had seemed more desirable than his own. And now, with this peace, this sanctuary, his garden and his pigs, a job he enjoyed doing and was valued for, and Karen's regular visits, he had found a life that suited every corner of his mind and fibre of his being. But with the appointment of Archdeacon Crampton as a trustee, everything changed. The fear of what Karen might demand of him was only an added worry to the overwhelming anxiety that had come with the arrival of the Archdeacon. On the occasion of the Archdeacon's first visit, Father Sebastian had said to him, "Archdeacon Crampton may call in to see you, Eric, sometime on Sunday or Monday. The bishop has appointed him as a trustee, and I expect there will be questions he will find it necessary to ask." There had been something in Father Sebastian's voice as he spoke the last words which had put Eric on guard. He said, "Questions about my job here, Father?" "About the terms of your employment, about anything which enters his mind, I have no doubt. He may want to look around the cottage." He had wanted to look around the cottage. He had arrived shortly after 9 o'clock on Monday morning. Karen, unusually, had stayed for Sunday night and had left in a hurry at 7:30. She had had an appointment in London at 10 o'clock and had already left it dangerously late. The Monday morning traffic on the A12 was bad, particularly as it approached London. In the rush, and Karen was always in a rush, she had forgotten that her bra and a pair of knickers were still hanging on the clothesline at the side of the cottage. They were the first thing that the Archdeacon saw as he came down the path. Without introducing himself, he said, "I didn't realize you had a visitor." Eric snatched the offending articles from the line and stuffed them into his pocket, realizing even as he did so that the act, in its mixture of embarrassment and furtiveness, was a mistake. He said, "My sister has been here for the weekend, Father." "I'm not your father. I don't use that term. You can call me Archdeacon." "Yes, Archdeacon." He was very tall, certainly over 6 foot, square-faced with bright darting eyes under thick but well-shaped eyebrows and a beard. They walked down the path towards the pigsty in silence. At least, thought Eric, there was nothing he could complain about in the state of the garden. The pigs greeted them with far louder squealing than was normal. The Archdeacon said, "I hadn't realized you kept pigs. Do you provide pork for the college?" "Sometimes, Archdeacon, but they don't eat much pork. Their meat comes from the butcher in Lowestoft. I just keep pigs. I asked Father Sebastian if I could, and he gave permission." "How much of your time do they take up?" "Not much, not much, Archdeacon. They seem extremely noisy, but at least they don't smell." There was no answer to that. The Archdeacon turned back to the house and Eric followed him. In the sitting room, he mutely offered one of the four upright rush-bottomed chairs round the square table. The Archdeacon seemed not to notice the invitation. He stood with his back to the fireplace and surveyed the room. The two armchairs, one a rocker, one a Windsor chair with a padded cushion in patchwork, the low bookcase along the whole of one wall, the posters which Karen had brought with her and fixed to the wall with blue tack. The Archdeacon said, "I suppose the stuff you've used to put up these posters doesn't damage the wall?" "It shouldn't. It's specially made. It's like chewing gum." Then the Archdeacon pulled out one of the chairs sharply and sat down, motioning Eric to the other. The questions which followed were not aggressively put, but Eric felt that he was a suspect under interrogation, accused of some as yet unnamed crime. "How long have you worked here? 4 years, isn't it?" "Yes, Archdeacon. And your duties are what, precisely?" His duties had never been precise. Eric said, "I'm a general handyman. I mend anything that gets broken, if it isn't electrical, and I do the outside cleaning. That means I wash down the cloister floor, sweep up the courtyard, and clean the windows. Mr. Pilbeam is responsible for the inside cleaning, and there's a woman comes in from Raiden to help." "Hardly an onerous job. The garden looks well kept. You're fond of gardening?" "Yes, very fond. But it's hardly large enough to supply vegetables for the college." "Not all the vegetables, but I grow too much for my own use, so I take the surplus up to the kitchen for Mrs. Pilbeam, and sometimes I give vegetables to people in the other cottages."
"Do they pay for them?"
"Oh, no, Archdeacon, nobody pays."
"And what do you get paid for these not very arduous duties?"
"I get the minimum wage based on 5 hours' work a day." He didn't say that neither he nor the college had worried too much about hours. Sometimes the work was done in less than 5 hours. Sometimes it took longer.
"And in addition, you get this cottage rent-free. You pay, no doubt, for your own heating, lighting, and, of course, your own council tax."
"I pay my council tax."
"And what about Sundays?"
"Sunday's my day off."
"I was thinking of church. You attend the church here?"
He did occasionally attend church, but only for evensong, when he would sit at the back and listen to the music and Father Sebastian's and Father Martin's measured voices, speaking words which were unfamiliar but beautiful to hear. But that couldn't be what the Archdeacon meant. He said, "I don't usually go to church on Sunday."
"But didn't Father Sebastian ask you about that when he appointed you?"
"No, Archdeacon. He asked me whether I could do the job."
"He didn't ask you whether you were a Christian?"
And here at least he had an answer. He said, "I am Christian, Archdeacon. I was christened when I was a baby. I've got a card somewhere." He looked vaguely around, as if the remembered card with its record of the christening, its sentimental picture of Christ blessing the little children, might suddenly materialize. There was a silence. He realized that the answer had been unsatisfactory. He wondered whether he ought to offer coffee, but surely 9:30 was too early. The silence lengthened, and then the archdeacon got up. He said,
"I see that you live very comfortably here, and Father Sebastian seems pleased with you, but nothing lasts forever, however comfortable. St. Anselm's has existed for 140 years, but the church, indeed the world, has changed a great deal in that time. I would suggest that if you do hear of another job that might suit you, you should seriously consider applying for it."
Eric said, "You mean that St. Anselm's might close?" He sensed that the archdeacon had gone further than he had intended.
"I'm not saying that. These matters needn't concern you. I'm just suggesting, for your own good, that you shouldn't think that you have a job here for life, that's all."
And then he left. Standing at the door, Eric watched him striding across the headland towards the college. He was seized with an extraordinary emotion. His stomach churned, and there was a taste bitter as bile in his mouth. In a life in which he had carefully avoided strong emotion, he was feeling an overpowering physical response for the second time in his life. The first had been the realization of his love for Karen, but this was different. This was as powerful, but more disturbing. He knew that what he was feeling for the first time in his life was hatred for another human being. 12. Dalgleish waited in the hall while Father Martin went to his room to collect his black cloak. When he reappeared, Dalgleish said, "Shall we take the car as far as we can?" He himself would have preferred to walk, but he knew that, for his companion, the trudge along the beach would be tiring, and not only physically. Father Martin accepted the suggestion with obvious relief. Neither of them spoke until they reached the point where the coastal track curved westward to join the Lowestoft Road. Dalgleish gently bumped his Jaguar onto the verge, then leaned over to help Father Martin with his seatbelt. He opened the door for him, and they set out for the beach. Now that the track had ended, they were walking a narrow path of sand and well-trodden grass between the waist-high banks of bracken and a tangle of bushes. In places, the bushes arched over the path, and they walked in tunneled dimness in which the surge of the sea had become no more than a distant rhythmic moan. Already the bracken was showing its first brittle gold, and it seemed that every step they took on the spongy turf released the pungent, nostalgic smells of autumn. They came out of the semi-darkness and saw the mere stretching before them, its dark, sinister smoothness separated only by some 50 yards of shingle from the tumbling brightness of the sea. It seemed to Dalgleish that there were fewer black tree stumps standing like prehistoric monuments guarding the mere. He looked for any trace of the wrecked ship, but could see only a single black spar shaped like a shark's fin, breaking the smooth stretch of the sand. Here the access to the beach was so easy that the 6 wooden steps half covered with sand and the single handrail were hardly necessary. At the top of the steps and built in a small hollow was an unpainted oak hut, rectangular and larger than an ordinary beach hut. Beside it was a heap of wood covered by a tarpaulin. Dalgleish lifted an edge and saw a neatly piled heap of planks and fractured timber, half painted blue. Father Martin said, "It's the remains of our old bathing hut. It was rather like the painted ones on Southwold Beach, but Father Sebastian thought it looked incongruous here on its own. It had become dilapidated and something of an eyesore, so we took the opportunity to demolish it. Father Sebastian thought that a plain wooden shack, unpainted, would look better.
This coast is so lonely that it's hardly needed when we come to bathe, but I suppose one should have somewhere to undress. We don't want to encourage our reputation for eccentricity. The hut also houses our small rescue boat. Swimming can be hazardous on this coast. Dalgliesh hadn't brought with him the spar of wood, nor had it been necessary. He had no doubt that it had come from the hut. Had Ronald Treves picked it up casually, as one sometimes did a spar of wood found on the beach, with no particular purpose except perhaps to hurl it into the sea? Had he found it here, or further along the shingle? Had he taken it, with the intention of using it to prod down the overhanging ledge of sand above his head? Or had there been a second person carrying that spar of broken timber? But Ronald Treves had been young, and presumably fit and strong. How could he have been forced into that suffocating sand without some mark on his body? The tide was retreating, and they walked down to the strip of smooth, damp sand at the edge of the curling waves, climbing over two groins. These were obviously new, and the ones he remembered from his boyhood visits lay between them, no more now than a few square-topped posts, sunk deeply in the sand, linked with rotting planks. Hitching up his cloak to climb over the green and slimy end of a groin, Father Martin said, "The European community provided these new groins. They're part of the defences against the sea. They've altered the appearance of the shore in some places. I expect there's more sand now than you remember." They had walked about 200 yards when Father Martin said quietly, "This is the place," and began walking towards the cliff. Dalgliesh saw that there was a cross sticking into the sand made from two pieces of driftwood tightly bound. Father Martin said, "We placed the cross here the day after we found Ronald. So far it has stayed in place. Perhaps passers-by haven't liked to disturb it. I don't suppose it will last for long. Once we get the winter storms, the sea will reach this far." Above the cross, the sandy cliff was a rich terracotta, and looked in places as if it had been sliced with a spade. At the cliff edge, a fringe of grasses trembled in the gently moving air. To left and right, there were several places where the cliff face had shifted, leaving deep cracks and crevices beneath overhanging ledges. It would, he thought, have been perfectly possible to lie with one's head under such a ledge and prod upwards with a stick, bringing down a half-ton of heavy sand. But it would take an extraordinary act of will or of desperation. He could think of few more dreadful ways to die, and if Ronald Treves had wanted to kill himself, surely to swim out to sea until cold and exhaustion overcame him was a more merciful option. So far the word suicide had not been mentioned between him and Father Martin, but now he felt that it had to be said. "This is a death, Father, which looks more like suicide than accident. But if Ronald Treves wanted to kill himself, why not swim out to sea? Ronald would never have done that. He was frightened of the sea. He couldn't even swim. He never bathed when the others came to swim. And I don't think I've ever seen him walking on the beach. That's one of the reasons why I find it surprising that he chose to come to St. Anselm's instead of applying to one of the other theological colleges." He paused and said, "I was afraid that you might think that suicide was more likely than accident. The possibility is deeply distressing to us all. If Ronald killed himself without us even knowing that he was so unhappy, then we failed him unforgivably. I can't really believe that he came here with the intention of committing what for him would have been a grave sin." Dalgliesh said, "He took off his cloak and cassock and folded them neatly. Would he do that if he were just intending to scramble up the cliff?" "He might do. It would be difficult to scramble up anywhere, wearing either. There was something particularly poignant about those clothes. He had placed them so precisely. The sleeves folded inwards. It was as if he had packed them for a journey. But then, he was a careful boy. Dalgliesh thought, but why climb the cliff? If he was searching for something, what could it possibly be? These friable, ever-changing banks of compacted sand with a thin stratum of pebbles and stones were hardly a reasonable hiding place. There were, he knew, occasional interesting finds to be made, including pieces of amber or human bones washed up from graveyards now long under the sea. But if Treves had glimpsed such an object, where was it now? Nothing of interest had been found by his body except that single spar of wood. They walked back along the beach in silence, Dalgliesh accommodating his long stride to Father Martin's less certain steps. The elderly priest had bent his head to the wind and drawn his black cloak tightly around him. For Dalgliesh, it was like walking with the personification of death. When they were back in the car, Dalgliesh said, I'd like to have a word with the member of staff who found Mrs. Munro's body. A Mrs. Pilbeam, wasn't it? And it would be helpful if I could speak to the doctor. But it's difficult to think of the justification for that. I don't want to arouse suspicion where none exists. This death has been distressing enough without that. Father Martin said, Dr. Metcalf is due to look in at the college this afternoon. One of the students, Peter Buckhurst, is recovering from glandular fever. It started at the end of last term. His parents are serving overseas, so we kept him for the holidays to ensure that he got some care and nursing. When he calls, George Metcalf usually takes the opportunity to exercise his two dogs, if he has a half an hour or so to spare before his next appointment. We may catch him. They were fortunate. As they drove between the towers and into the courtyard, they saw a Range Rover parked at the front of the house. Dalgliesh and Father Martin got out of the car as Dr. Metcalf came down the steps, carrying his case and turning to wave goodbye to someone unseen within the house. The doctor was revealed as a tall, weather-beaten man who must, thought Dalgliesh, be nearing retirement. He made his way to the Range Rover and opened the door to be greeted.